Shri Parikshit Uvacha.
Shri Parikshit
said,
Brahman,
O Brahmana
Sukadev,
Brahmani,
in the absolute truth,
Anirdeshe,
which cannot be described in words,
Nirgune,
which has no qualities,
Guna,
the qualities of material nature.
Brittaya,
whose scope of action.
Katam,
how.
Charanti,
function.
By referring.
Shrutaya,
the Vedas.
Sakshat,
directly.
Sat,
to material substance.
Asataha,
and its subtle cause.
Hare,
in that which is transcendental.
Translation.
Sri Parikshit said,
O Brahmana,
how can the Vedas
directly describe the Supreme Absolute Truth
who cannot be described in words?
The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature,
but the Supreme is devoid of these qualities,
being transcendental to all material manifestations and their causes.
Purport.
So this is quite a technical purport in parts. So you probably have to concentrate to hear it. One of those purports, if you space out for a second, you're not really going to understand the rest of it from that point on.
Before beginning his commentary on this chapter, Srila Sridhar Swami prays,
Vagisha yasha vadane lakshmi yasha chavakshasi
yashaste hidaye sambit tam nrishimham mahambhaje.
I worship Lord Nrishimha, within whose mouth reside the great masters of eloquence,
upon whose chest reside the goddess of fortune,
and within whose heart resides the divine potency of consciousness.
Sampradaya visudyatam sriya nirvanda yantrita
shruti stuti mita vyakyam karishyami tamati.
Desiring to purify my sampradaya and being bound by duty, I will briefly comment on the prayers of the personified Vedas to the best of my realization.
Shamara Bhagavatam Purvai Sarata Sani Sevitam Mayatutarupaspristam Uchistam Upachiyate.
Inasmuch as Srimad Bhagavatam has already been perfectly honoured by my predecessors' explanations, I can only gather together the remnants of what they have honoured.
Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur offers his own invocation.
Mama ratna vinigbhavam ratnya yapiri chinvataha asanto santo dhirhemi nashva svandha vinodakrit.
The saintly devotees may laugh at me for becoming a jewel merchant, though I know nothing about precious jewels, but I feel no shame, for at least I may entertain them.
Namesti vadushyapi napi bhakti virakti rakti na tatapi lolyat sudurgama diva bhavami vidas tuchata chintamani rasi kridnu.
Though I have no wisdom, devotion or detachment, I am still greedy to take the philosopher's stone of the Vedas prayers from the fortress in which it is being kept.
Mam nityatayam aviveka vayo pravatate patayitum balachet likam yata swami sanatana shri krishna griba stamba kitavalamba.
If the wind of indiscretion, my failure to acknowledge my lowly position, threatens to knock me down, then while writing this commentary, I must hold on to the effulgent pillars of the feet of Sridhar Swami, Sanatana Goswami, and Lord Sri Krishna.
Pranamya Shri Gurum Bhuyaha Shri Krishna Karuna Navam Loka Natam Jagats Chakshur Shri Shukam Tam Upasaye. Repeatedly bowing down to my divine spiritual master and to Lord Shri Krishna, the ocean of mercy, I take shelter of Sri Sukadeva Goswami, the protector of the world and its universal eye. At the end of the preceding chapter, Sukadeva Goswami told Parikit Maharaj, Evam sva bhakti yoga jan bhagavan bhakta bhakti mam utsi vadishya sanmagam punna dvaravatim agat. Quote, thus, O King, the personality of Godhead, who is the devotee of his own devotees, stayed for some time with his two great devotees, teaching them how perfect saints behave. Then he returned to Dwarka. Unquote. In this verse, the word sanmagam can be understood in at least three ways. In the first, sat is taken to mean devotee of the Supreme Lord, and thus sanmagam means the path of bhakti yoga, devotional service. In the second, with sat meaning a seeker of transcendental knowledge, sanmagam means the philosophical path of knowledge, which has impersonal Brahman as its object. And in the third, with sat referring to the transcendental sound of the Vedas, sanmagam means the process of following Vedic injunctions. Both the second and the third of these interpretations of sanmagam lead to the question of how the Vedas can describe the absolute truth. Srila Sridhar Swami elaborately analyzes this problem in terms of the traditional discipline of Sanskrit poetries. We should consider that words have three kinds of expressive capacities called sabdabrittis. These are the different ways a word refers to its meaning, distinguished as mukhyabritti, lakshanabritti and gaunabritti. The sabdabritti termed mukhya is the primary literal meaning of a word. This is also known as abhidha, a word's primary, denotation or dictionary meaning. Mukhyabritti is further divided into two subcategories, namely rudhi and yoga. A primary meaning is called rudhi when it is based on conventional usage, and yoga when it is derived from another word's meaning by regular etymological rules. For example, the word go, cow, is an example of rudhi since its relation with its literal meaning is purely conventional. The denotation of the word pachaka, chef, on the other hand, is a yoga vritti through the word's derivation from the root pach, to cook, by addition of the agent suffix ka. Besides its mukhya vritti, or primary meaning, a word can also be used in a secondary metaphorical sense. This usage is called lakshana. The rule is that a word should not be understood metaphorically if it is mukhya vritti, if its mukhya vritti makes sense in the given context. Only after mukhya vritti fails to convey a word's meaning may lakshana vritti be justifiably presumed. The function of lakshana is technically explained in the Kavya Shastras as an extended reference pointing to something in some way related to the object of the literal meaning. Thus the phrase Gangiyam Goshaha literally means the cowherd village in the Ganges. But that idea is absurd. So here, Gangayam should rather be understood by its lakshana to mean on the bank of the Ganges, the bank being something related to the river Ganga. Gaunabritti is a special kind of lakshana where the meaning is extended to some idea of similarity. For example, in the statement Shimho Devadatta, Devadatta is a lion. Heroic Devadatta is metaphorically called a lion because of his lion-like qualities. In contrast, the example of the general kind of lakshana, namely Gangayam Goshya, involves a relationship not of similarity but of location. In this first verse of the 87th chapter, Parikit Maharaj expresses doubts as to how the words of the Vedas can refer to the absolute truth by any of the valid kinds of sabdabritti. He asks, Katam Sakshat Charanti, how can the Vedas directly describe Brahman by Rudhamukya Britti, literal meaning, based on convention? After all, the absolute truth is anidesha, inaccessible to designation. And how can the Vedas even describe Brahman by gaunavritti, metaphor based on similar qualities? The Vedas are guna-vrittaya, full of qualitative descriptions, but Brahman is nirguna, without qualities. Obviously, a metaphor based on similar qualities cannot apply in the case of something that has no qualities. Furthermore, Parikit Maharaj points out that Brahman is sad asataha param, beyond all causes and effects. Having no connection with any manifest existence, subtle or gross, the Absolute cannot be expressed by either yoga vritti, a meaning derived etymologically, or lakshana metaphor, since both require some relationship of Brahman to other entities. Thus King Parikit is puzzled as to how the words of the Vedas can directly describe the Absolute Truth. So that should be perfectly clear to everyone.
Yeah.
At this point, I was speaking English. this it's actually a very interesting question, because understanding this question, we can understand the chapter and understanding the this chapter, we can understand the essential teachings of the Vedas. So now in the previous verse, what they're saying here is that Krishna was speaking to Shrutadev and Bahulashva, and it described there that he described to them the path of saintly personalities, how saintly personalities behave. Now, in using that term, it can be satmargyam, it can be taken in three different ways, as referring to the devotees, or those pursuing philosophical knowledge, or those following the various rules and regulations of the Vedas. So generally what can happen is that as soon as there is some opportunity to misinterpret a statement in Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita, immediately rascals will take that opportunity. So now Parikit Maharaj, he can perceive this, and therefore he is asking this question so that there is no doubt, there are no gaps left in the philosophy of Srimad Bhagavatam, so that rascals can give some other meaning. And this is where understanding Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, each and every verse should be understood in context with the entire message of the Srimad Bhagavatam and not taken out of context. The only way generally that rascals can actually misinterpret a verse is when they do that. They take a verse and they speak it out of context to people who are ignorant of perhaps the whole message of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So for instance, for the general mass of people who may not be expert in scrutinizingly studying the Srimad Bhagavatam, if someone quoted, "Oh, here is this verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna was speaking to Bahulashva and Shrutadev on the path of the saintly devotees, and that refers to the path of philosophical speculation. So therefore we have evidence in the Srimad Bhagavatam that Krishna is teaching the path of philosophical speculation to his followers." So Parikit Maharaj, of course, is... certainly doesn't want to allow that opening. So it's very interesting here that in these prayers, Srila Sridhar Swami, who's the original commentator on the Srimad Bhagavatam, before commenting on this verse, he first prays to Lord Nrisimhadev. And, you would almost question why... In particular, is he praying to Lord Nrisimhadev, who is the killer of demons? is he praying, you know, to that particular feature of the Lord in order that he can speak transcendental truths on this chapter. And it is, you know, for that particular reason that there are many unscrupulous, atheistic, impersonalist, Mayavadi type persons who have a business to try and destroy any concept of propagating the personality of Godhead as the absolute truth. So Lord Nrisimhadev, he protects us from demons externally, and he also protects us internally from our own demons. Demons in the form of doubt or misunderstanding. Therefore, we find that in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna also, at various times when he was in doubt, he would address Krishna as Madhusudan, the killer of the demon Madhu. We see that originally, for instance, in the first verse, actually in first chapter, text number 34, Arjuna addresses Krishna as Madhusudan. You know, how, you know, I am not prepared to kill all these personalities, my teachers, friends, relatives, so many different, you know, persons like that. I'm not prepared to kill them in exchange for this kingdom. You know, that's not my duty. So he's addressing Krishna as Madhusudan, in other words, saying, you killed demons. Okay? I can understand that sort of a duty. Let's kill some demons. But, you know, you are asking me to kill even my guru. So in that sense, there was a slight sarcastic use of the word, you know, Madhusudan. But actually, in the first verse of the second chapter, then Sanjaya addresses Krishna as Madhusudan. And in that sense, he was speaking to Dhritarashtra, and he was saying to Dhritarashtra that you've got no hope of winning this battle, because Krishna, who is the killer of great demons, he will destroy the demon of illusion or misunderstanding within Arjuna's heart, and therefore Arjuna will rise above this petty weakness of heart, and he will fight. He's not going away from this battlefield, and ultimately he will be victorious. So Sanjaya was using Madhusudan in that sense, and we actually see that then later, of course, that Arjuna surrenders unto Krishna, and then after surrendering unto Krishna, he also used Madhusudan in that same sense that Sanjaya was using Madhusudan, that for instance in the 6th chapter, text number 33, he says to Krishna that, you know, after Krishna described the yoga process, and he said, oh, Madhusudan, you know, how do you expect me to you know, how can I attain perfection through such a method, you know, clear up this doubt. Also in the 8th chapter, in the 2nd verse, Krishna addressed Arjuna addressed Krishna as Madhusudan. He asked him, you know, tell me about Brahman, tell me about the living entity, tell me about the material world. These are very, very difficult subject matters to understand. Even great saintly personalities misunderstand them. But you know, Madhusudan, you can destroy this illusion, this misunderstanding, and therefore he addressed him as Madhusudan. So doubt, misunderstanding or illusion is sometimes compared to a demon, or as Prabhupada puts it, it's like being possessed by a ghost. Because sometimes when you're actually possessed by a ghost, you cannot perform your proper activities. You know, your proper duty. You do some other nonsense, but you can't there's a confusion. So in that sense, illusion, misunderstanding, in the same way Arjuna, you know, as if he was haunted by a ghost. It, here is this great, powerful warrior, follower of Vedic culture, and yet he had become completely overcome by this demon of illusion, misunderstanding and doubt that he could no longer perform his duty. And factually, we see that the whole world is in this same position. Everyone in this world, apart from those who actually know the central teachings of the Vedas, they have no idea how to perform their duty. They don't know what their duty is, and even if there is some inkling, they cannot perform their duty. They cannot do the correct thing. It's like they are haunted by the ghost of foolishness and ignorance. So, therefore, the difficulty, of course, is that although internally people already have misunderstandings on what they, you know, what it, who they are thinking they're the body. That's the basic illusion. I am this material body. All these people are related to me in some way, and they're not related to me. These are my possessions in relationship to my body. That's the basic illusion throughout the whole world. And therefore, they're acting on the material platform and cannot perform their duty as a spirit soul in relationship to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because ultimately we are the eternal servants of Krishna. So that misconception is already there. People are already under that illusion. What makes it worse is you have these so-called great philosophers who are actually catering to that mentality. Some of them are saying, yes, there is no nothing beyond material existence. Therefore, just, you know, enjoy in this material world. Of course, in Kali Yuga, there's no real Vedic conception of if you want to enjoy, at least you may have to rise to the heavenly planets or, you know, rise to the mode of goodness or what have you. There's complete foolishness. They have no idea how to enjoy. So they do very, very foolish things. But the point is that they're being taught, yes, just enjoy this material world, that's it. Once you die, everything is finished. Others are teaching that the absolute truth, the reality beyond the temporary illusion of this material world, temporary existence of this material world, is impersonal. So, in this way, of course, if people are not attracted to an impersonal philosophy, if people think, you know, when I die, you know, there's no sex life, there's no, you know, drinking, there's no this and there's no that, I don't want to go, I don't want to merge into some impersonal liberation. It's not very attractive. And we see that Lord Shiva, he was actually asked to come and teach this philosophy in the form of Sankaracharya. He appeared to teach this impersonalism because it actually encourages materialism, because it's so unattractive. So, therefore, we see here that, as is pointed out in the verse, that both the second and the third of these interpretations of Sanmargam lead to the question of how the Vedas can describe the absolute truth. Right? So, if we take that saintly people are those who follow the Vedas and do not believe in an existence beyond the material world, that leads to Parikshit Maharaj's question. And we see an example of that in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter, text number 42-43, where Krishna says that those who are bewildered by the flowery words of the Vedas, they're attracted to material sense gratification and opulence, they think there is nothing beyond this. So they have no faith. Liberation, no. They have no faith in liberation. You know, everything what exists exists in this material world. We can go up to the heavenly planets, we can come down and go to hell, but that's it at that. So for those persons, it would actually lead to that question as to for them, of course, thinking that the material world is all in all, then for them the Vedas are not describing something transcendental. Right? That's the point. And they would conceive that, you know, the material world, words, material sounds, I have a material mind, and you know, that's it. What the Vedas are describing is, you know, existence rotating in this material world. For the impersonalists also, the third category, that also leads to this question that for them, Brahman has no qualities. So this is a very interesting point here with Parikkhita Maharaj. So he's saying, okay, if those who are impersonalists think that the Vedas are describing impersonal Brahman, he's sort of saying, how can that be? Because one, Brahman has no qualities, impersonal Brahman. Therefore, how the Vedas are filled with description of qualities. So how could they be referring to the absolute truth? Srila Prabhupada in his Krishna book, he puts it very nicely, always takes some very deep, difficult philosophy, and he just manages to speak it in such a way that is just so accessible to ordinary people. So he describes in the Krishna book that Parikkhita Maharaj is asking that how with our material mind and material words can we understand transcendence? So we read that purport, very, very technical, a lot of technical explanations, how we can, you know, how is it possible for the direct meaning or the secondary meanings of words, you know, to describe the absolute truth? Because the absolute truth has no qualities, it is beyond cause and effect, it is beyond relationship to anything else, therefore we cannot speak about it. So if Brahman, which is indiscriminate, indescribable, has no qualities, generally when we describe something, we talk about its substance, so it's an object. So there must be some. So if we talk about something, it's made of earth, it's made of wood, it's made of fire, air, ether. You know, it's some substance, subtle or gross. Brahman doesn't have that. It's not any substance that we know of. It's actually beyond substance. It's not substance. It's not non-substance. That's Brahman. If we talk about some substance, it has some quality, it has some colour, some smell, some taste. Impersonal Brahman has none of those, no qualities like that. if we talk about something with our words and our material mind, it has some class. Of course, when something has a quality, then it has a particular class, classification according to those qualities, and particular objects have particular activities or particular functions. In this way, we can describe anything according to these things, but Brahman has none of these things. There's no activity, there's no qualities, impersonal Brahman. So therefore, how can we describe that? Yet, the impersonalists are claiming that the Vedas are describing impersonal Brahman. So Parikkhita Maharaj is asking, so, you know, how can that be? Now, in the Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada, again, he gives this essential sentence And he says the reason that Parikshit Maharaj is asking this question is because he is trying to determine from Sukadeva Goswami's answer whether the ultimate object of meditation, concentration, should be the impersonal Brahman or the personality of Godhead. So, you know, Srila Prabhupada, we see with a perfect understanding of Parikshit Maharaj's, you know, mode of thought, his purpose. It's not just a question just for the sake of it, but it is a question to so that the essential teachings of the Vedas are revealed by answering that question. And it destroys any opportunity for someone to misinterpret Srimad Bhagavatam, any of its verses, in an impersonal way, which some people do. So, therefore we see that after Srila Prabhupada asks that question on behalf of Parikshit Maharaj, that the real purpose is, should we worship, you know, are we being directed in the Vedas to worship the impersonal Brahman, or are we being directed to worship the personality of Godhead? Srila Prabhupada immediately answers. He says there are three different aspects: progressive realizations of the absolute truth, the impersonal Brahman, the Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So you see, Srila Prabhupada, when you read the Krishna book, literally within a paragraph, Srila Prabhupada has summed up the essence of this question and immediately given the answer. So before you go, you know, very far in the chapter, you've already got the answer. There's no scope for any speculation. All speculation stopped right from the very beginning. That's the very nature, that's how a devotee, that's his activity, that's his mission, is to not leave, you know, one little gap for rascals to jump in and misinterpret the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita, or the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the very nature of a devotee. They protect very ferociously, backed up by Lord Nrisimhadev, the path of devotional service. So, therefore, we see how Srila Sridhar Swami, he prays to Lord Nrisimhadev. I worship Lord Nrisimha, within whose mouth reside the great masters of eloquence, upon whose chest resides the goddess of fortune, and within whose heart resides the divine potency of consciousness. So, now, Srila Prabhupada, in presenting the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, he is taking shelter of his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, who's taking shelter of his spiritual master, and all the way back. So you see here that again, Sridhar Swami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they offer these prayers that I'm taking shelter of Krishna, I'm taking shelter of Sukadeva Goswami, Sanatan Goswami, my own spiritual master, like this. And they are pillars. So you see in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's prayers, he is saying very humbly that the saintly devotees may laugh at me for becoming a jewel merchant, though I know nothing about precious jewels, but I feel no shame, for at least I may entertain them. Though I have no wisdom, devotion, or detachment, I am still greedy to take the philosopher's stone of the Vedas, prayers, from the fortress in which it is being kept. So this is a very interesting prayer as well, that Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he is feeling unqualified for this great task of preaching Krishna consciousness. And as we can, you know, we're reading these verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Some of them are very philosophical, Some we see with the relationships between Krishna and his various devotees, the levels of love described, the reciprocation is something so alien to us. You know, love, the concept of love, especially on the higher levels, is so alien to us that we have great difficulty understanding, you know, what are they talking about? You know, what did Krishna just say to the gopis? What did they just say? You know, what just happened then? Very, very deep, you know, the love is so deep, intense, and pure, that it's very difficult for us to understand that. These philosophical concepts here, we're entering into this chapter here, the prayers of the personified Vedas. Very, very, the essence of Vedic knowledge. So, naturally, one should feel unqualified. That Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he's saying that nevertheless, I feel no shame, for at least I may entertain them. So he's not saying there that I'm going to preach Krishna consciousness because I'm unqualified. It's going to be really a foolish attempt, and the acharyas will all have a good laugh at that. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying there is that to understand that we really we see with Srila Prabhupada that Srila Prabhupada, he would in the early 60s encouraged people to come to Krishna consciousness, and they may have met him once or twice, read a few chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, and then he would say, now you go and open a temple. You know, one man, go and chant and preach at that. Srila Prabhupada wasn't doing that for entertainment. Let's have a good laugh, you know, at that. It was entertainment in the sense that, just like a parent, when they see their children trying to do the things that adults do, it is entertaining, but there's no condescendence there at all. It is there is only love, compassion, and a protective instinct. And at the same time, because they're making an attempt, the parent will usually, you know, hold the hand of the child. So, for instance, the child is learning to walk, so the parent will hold the hand of the child and help the child to walk. They're like a pillar that the child can lean upon, and in that way they're able to take their first steps, not, you know, fall over too many times, not bang themselves, not hurt themselves, even though they're prone to do that. So in that way, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, you know, he is taking that mood like a child spiritually. I'm depending upon my the strength of my spiritual predecessors to hold me up. You know, they are the pillars of strength. And although my activities may be amusing in one sense, by their love and compassion, they will allow us to do something which we may, they will allow us to gradually become qualified by their mercy. So in that way, he is offering this prayer. So that is actually the very nature of the devotees, that a Vaishnava, they try to take a fifth class man and make them into a first class man. And that is the real mood of the Vedas. The Vedas are actually trying to elevate people from a very low existence where they're almost ascending into animal life to a transcendental situation. That's the mood of the Vedas. And only the path of saints, therefore when Krishna taught Shrutadeva and Bahulashva the path of saintly persons, is referring, of course, to the devotees, because they're actually following the mood of the Vedas to try and elevate people. They're not trying to have some monopoly that you remain conditioned, you remain in ignorance, And I will keep the knowledge of the Vedas to myself, because in that way I can perform so many yajnas and ceremonies and peddle a few mantras and what have you. I can become very opulent and full of prestige, and you will remain in your position this way. But if I allow you to chant these mantras, to know these mantras and to study the Vedas and to do these things, that undermines my position. Therefore we see, someone was telling me the other day that there's a movement that is coming from some places in India, that Rath Yatra, you know, is for them. It is not meant to be, there should not be Rath Yatra anywhere else except Jagannath Puri. So that is not the mood of the Vedas. But, you know, some quarter. Generally, actually, the population of India, they are known for their great generosity. You know, generally. So we're not talking, you know, there's some pockets of miserly people. Actually, Srila Prabhupada gives an example of the how you can see the difference between the miserly nature of the West and the very magnanimous nature of India. One time when they went to a preaching program, I think it was, and after the program, Shamananda drove them there in the little black type vehicle. What's that?
Ambassador.
Right. They all drive the same car. So anyway, after the program, they went and hopped it back into the car. Shamananda tried to start the car and he couldn't get the key to work. And he was, you know, getting really angry, really frustrated, and then he got angry, he got out of the car, he said, Prabhupada, I'm going to go get a taxi. So while he was doing that, two Indian men dressed in suits came in and sat in the front of the car. Prabhupada was still sitting in the back with Shrutakirti. Shrutakirti started to freak out, you know, what's going on here? But Prabhupada was completely relaxed, and he actually began to have a conversation in their language. And then those men started up the car and drove Prabhupada to his next destination. So Shrutakirti had worked out that what had happened, of course, is that they'd actually hopped in the wrong car. But when these men realised that they'd hopped into their car, they just immediately offered, oh, here's, you know, let us drive you to your destination. And Prabhupada said after that that, you know, if that had happened in the West, we'd be in a lot of trouble. So it's a, you know, the distinction, you know, the Indian nation is very, very, very generous. You don't find, I remember actually when I went to India in, I think it was, every time I went I got sick, but anyway, one time I was so ill, and I got off the bus, and we're in the middle of nowhere, and they had to fix a tyre, which can be anywhere from an hour to 3 days, you know. In India. So I was so sick I couldn't stand up, and these people, Indian people, come up to me, you know, villagers, and they could see I wasn't well, and they said, "You come here." You know, of course, being a Westerner, you know, you think, "Oh, you know, they're going to rob me or what have you." But you know, I was so sick I couldn't stand up. So they actually took me into their house. They gave me a bed to lie on. I said, "You lay here. We'll tell you when the bus is coming." And then, you know, later they woke me up, gave me a little drink, what have you. They said, "The bus is ready now," like that. And so I went. You know, you wouldn't find that anywhere in the West. You know, it's just, it doesn't happen. But in India, it's still common. So, but there are, you know, there are pockets of, you know, persons who do not represent India, do not represent the culture of the Vedas, and they are very miserly that let us keep this Vedic information to ourselves. Here, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he wants to greedy to take the jewels of the Vedas, but not so that he becomes wealthy, so that he can distribute them, so that everyone can become wealthy, because there are so many jewels in the Vedas. Just like Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there is the tree of devotional service. He planted the tree of devotional service in this world, and it produced the fruits of prema. And there were so many fruits, even though he was God. He said, I cannot enjoy all these fruits. I have to distribute them to the world. Like that. So that is the mood, you know, so who can help me? And still, that is what we are doing this very day. We are trying to distribute this mercy. the fruits are still there. They're still growing. There's so much. We shouldn't let it go to waste. I remember when I lived in Red Hill on the Mornington Peninsula, across the road from me, just right across the road, was 14 acres of avocado trees. Right? So this lady lived there with a couple of her children, and they couldn't manage the avocado orchard, and so every year the avocados would fall to the ground and rot. So one day I went over and I said to her, I have, you know, some children at home, and you know, we love avocados. Can we have just you know, maybe a few? No. That was it. I'll never forget that. She'd rather have the rot on the ground than give us a couple. She wouldn't let me have any ever. So that is that same mentality, you know, of trying to monopolize Vedic knowledge, Vedic mantras, you know, for one's own benefit rather than just distributing. So, you know, actually this is done. The impersonalists, they actually make Vedic knowledge inaccessible. In fact, impersonalism, impersonal absolute truth, cannot be the goal of the Vedas. Because, as described, impersonal absolute truth does not say, I am going to distribute, reveal myself to all the conditioned souls in the material world. It doesn't have an activity. It doesn't, it is existence, eternal existence. So therefore, the only way, so there's no descending process, and yet the whole Vedas are based upon a descending process. But Brahman, impersonal Brahman, does not descend. So therefore the only way to get to Brahman would be an ascending process, and that's Parikit Maharaj's problem. You can't ascend to Brahman realization because you're dealing with the material mind, material words, material concepts. How can you ever get out of that, you know, materialism to approach transcendence? So therefore, you know, his question is, you know, is it the impersonal Brahman actually being represented by the Vedas as the ultimate goal? In fact, you know, in his question, it's understood it must be the personal aspect of Brahman that is actually being propagated in the Vedas. Because only by revelation, if the Supreme Brahman in its personal aspects reveals itself to the conditioned souls out of his own causeless mercy and by his own transcendental activities or leelas and reveals his name and form and qualities, then even though the conditioned souls are completely unqualified, by the mercy descending from above, they gradually become purified. And to this end, we see that the Vedas gradually offer different means of purification, and ultimately all the Vedas, the purification leads us to the opportunity to understand the holy name of the Lord. All Vedic knowledge are bringing us to this point to understand the glories of the Lord's holy names, that they are non-different from the Lord. I'm watching that clock. So therefore, we see that the Vedas give they give a process, and especially in the age of Kali, where people are particularly unqualified, how is it possible for them without the mercy descending? Therefore, in Kali Yuga, particularly the holy name of the Lord is very important, because everyone is so unqualified, but if someone chants the holy name of the Lord, even they have no understanding of the holy name of the Lord, the holy name still acts because it is self-effulgent. So when the one chants the holy name of the Lord, it is the self-effulgent, all-knowledgeable, supreme Lord, and the name reveals itself, reveals transcendental knowledge to the person who chanted the holy name. And therefore you see the essence, the most direct, the easiest, especially in Kali Yuga, the only process is to actually chant the holy name of the Lord. Even if people chant the holy name, that's called Namabhas. So people, if they chant the holy name in Namabhas, they can actually gradually fully realize God. And we see in this movement, this whole movement is based upon that. People come, they have no idea what is Varnasram, they have no idea what is a Vedic sacrifice, they have no idea of Vedic knowledge or philosophy, and they come into the temple room and they chant and they dance and they take prasadam. Next minute they're teaching the essence, you know, most confidential knowledge of the Vedas. Simply by the, you know, potency of the holy name. Even if the devotees are going down the street and they're chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and people on the other side, oh, there's a Hare Krishna, I'm a Hare Krishna. That person is being elevated in transcendental knowledge. There's actually sometimes the Chan Kazi in Lord Chaitanya's time, some of the orderlies, they would when they would see a devotee coming, they would start, you know, deriding them. Oh, Hari, you know, means one who takes everything away. So they say, oh, here comes the Haris, they will steal everything. Like that. And then the Chan Kazi says, but why you keep chanting Hari? And he says, since I started joking like this, I cannot stop chanting Hari. So, you know, the holy name of the Lord is the essence of Vedic knowledge, and the holy name of the Lord reveals the essence of Vedic knowledge. And therefore, because the holy name of the Lord can do that, it is a transcendental name. So the name and the Lord are non-different. And this proves that actually the goal of the Vedas is the personality of Godhead and not impersonal Brahman. And therefore we see as this chapter goes on that you know, the personified Vedas will offer so many glorification prayers of the personality of Godhead. So if there are any quick questions, just maybe a couple of minutes, yep.
So why hearing nature, you know, I feel like, you know, I could understand. But if now somebody asks me the same question, I won't be able to answer. So can you just give me some
somebody what Shukadeva Goswami? Srikadeva Goswami, Prigit Maharaj, yeah, is asking. He is asking that because of the last verse in the previous chapter, where Krishna described to Bahalasva and Shudadeva the path of saintly people, whether that Krishna is actually describing the path of bhakti, where the Vedas are teaching a personal absolute truth, or whether he's describing the path of philosophical speculation or karma kanda, in which there may be a materialistic or impersonal goal. All right? So he wants to clarify what Krishna taught them, and therefore he's asking, he seems to have an inkling that it can't really be just impersonal Brahman, and therefore he's saying the Vedas can't be just teaching impersonal Brahman for various different reasons. That doesn't make sense. Can you confirm this? Can you acknowledge this?
Particularly the question where he's saying that how can in the word form we describe the absolute truth which is transcendental?
Say that again.
That the absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
How can we directly describe the supreme absolute truth? It cannot be described in words.
Mm. So therefore, whatever descriptions there are in the Vedas describing the absolute truth as having qualities are referring to his spiritual qualities. Mm.
that sense, those words can describe spiritual.
Words can describe. Words can describe if those words have actually descended from the Supreme Lord Himself, where He is Himself describing His own transcendental nature. So therefore we see in the Bhagavad Gita it is full of words, but they're not actually material words. See, the impersonalists, it's them who claim that the words of the Vedas are material, not the personalists. For instance, the impersonalists think that if you take the names of God, which are in the Vedas, they're imperfect until you come to a platform of knowledge, and then when a person of knowledge chants those names, they have effect. You see? But the personalists, they don't consider that. As we described, they consider that when the names of God and the activities and what have you are mentioned in the Vedas, they're already perfect. Whatever your qualification is, they're transcendental. They're not material. It's impersonalists that claim that these things are material, not the personalists. Right? So that's why we're describing that, you know, if you approach fire and you know, you're in knowledge and you touch fire, you're going to get burnt. Right? If a child who doesn't have any knowledge of fire approaches fire, that child will get burnt in just the same way. The ignorance does not change the quality of the fire. Krishna's holy name is not changed in quality or potency due to our ignorance. It is always transcendental. Any other quick questions? Yep.
What should we do if we meet an impersonalist, Mayavadi or Buddhist?
Well, the Mayavadis, the impersonalists, what have you, they claim to be Vedantists. They claim that Vedanta is there for them. It is not meant for anyone else. They are the knowers of the Vedanta. So the Vaishnavas, they say, yes, that is true, in one sense, because danta means teeth and ve means without. So they are without teeth. They are without teeth in the sense that the Vaishnava acharyas have knocked out their teeth with their bold philosophical refutations of Mayavad philosophy. So we should knock their teeth out. On that note, Hare Krishna.